Chapter 42. Rudy Gunn paced the bridge like a nervous cat. Though the bump on his head had long since receded, a purple bruise still blemished his temple. Every few steps he would stop and scan the weathered dock of Çanakkale for signs of relief. Finding none, he would shake his head and resume pacing. This is crazy. We're on our third day of impoundment. When are we going to be released? Pitt looked up from the chart table where he was studying a map of the Turkish coast with Captain Kenfield. Our consulate in Istanbul has assured me that our release is imminent. The necessary paperwork is promised to be meandering through the local bureaucracy even as we speak. The whole situation is outrageous, Gunn complained. We're placed in lockdown while the killers of Tang and Iverson are allowed to slip free. Pitt couldn't argue with him, but he did understand the dilemma. Long before the Aegean explorer had contacted the Turkish Coast Guard, the Marine Authority had been alerted by two earlier radio calls. The first reported that the Numa ship was illegally salvaging a historic Turkish shipwreck protected by the Cultural Ministry. The second call reported two divers killed during the salvage operation. The Turks refused to identify the source of the calls, but rightfully acted on them in advance of the Aegean explorer's request. Once the Numa ship was escorted to the port city of Çanakkale and impounded, the case was turned over to the local police, further compounding the confusion. Pitt immediately phoned Dr. Rupay in Istanbul to document their approved presence on the wreck site. Then he phoned his wife, Lauren. She quickly badgered the State Department to push for their immediate release, even after the police had searched the ship and, finding no artifacts, slowly realized there was no basis for arrest. Rod Zeibig ducked his head through the doorway and broke the air of exasperation. You guys got a minute? Sure, Gunn replied. We're just busy here pulling our hair out of our heads one strand at a time. Zeibig stepped in with a folder in his hand and headed to the chart table. Maybe this will perk you up. I've got some information on your stone monolith. Apparently, it's not mine anymore, Gunn mused. Did you manage to remember your Latin inscription? Pitt asked, sliding over to allow room for Gunn and Zeibig to sit down. Yes, I actually wrote it down right when we got back to the ship, but put it aside during all the commotion. I finally examined it this morning and performed a formal translation. Tell me it's the gravestone of Alexander the Great, Gunn said wishfully. That would be wrong on two accounts, I'm afraid. The stone tablet is not a grave marker per se, but a memorial. And there's no mention of Alexander. He opened the folder, revealing a handwritten page of Latin that he had jotted down after viewing the monolith. The next page contained a typewritten translation, which he handed to Gunn. He read it silently at first, then aloud. In remembrance of Centurion Plautius, Scholae Palatini and loyal guardian of Helena, lost in battle at sea off this point. Faith, honor, fidelity. Cornicular Traianus. Centurion Plautius, Gunn repeated. It's a memorial to a Roman soldier? Yes, Zeibig replied, which adds veracity to Al's crown being of Roman origin, a gift from the Emperor Constantine. A Scholae Palatini loyal to Helena, Pitt said. The Scholae Palatini were the elite security force of the later Roman emperors, as I recall, similar to the Praetorian Guard. The reference to Helena must be Helena Augustus. That's right, Zeibig agreed. The mother of Constantine I, who ruled in the early 4th century. Helena lived from 248 to 330 AD, so the stone and the crown would presumably date to that era. Any idea who this Traianus is? Gunn asked. A cornicularii is a military officer, typically a deputy position. I searched some Roman databases for a Traianus, but came up empty. I guess the big mystery still remains. Where did the crown and monolith originate, and why were they in an Ottoman wreck? He gazed past Zeibig, perking up at the sight of two men in blue uniforms who were making their way down the quay toward the ship. Well, well, the local constables have returned, he said. I hope that's our parole papers they're carrying with them. Captain Kenfield met the officers on the dock and escorted them aboard, where Pitt and Gunn joined them in the wardroom. "I have your impoundment release here," the elder officer stated in clear English. He was a round-faced man with drooping ears and a thick black mustache. "Your government was very persuasive," he added with a thin smile. "You are free to go." "Where does the investigation of my murdered crewman stand?" Kenfield inquired. "We have reopened the case as a potential homicide. At present, however, we have no suspects." "What about that yacht, the Sultana?" Pitt asked. "Yes, we saw the boat nearly cut Dirk to shreds," Gunn pressed.
"We were able to trace that vessel to its owner, who informs us that you must be mistaken," the officer replied. "The Sultana is on a charter cruise off Lebanon. We received email photos this morning of the vessel moored in the port of Beirut."
"The Sultana was heavily damaged," Pitt said. "There is no way she could have sailed the Lebanon." The officer's assistant opened a briefcase and pulled out several printed photographs, which he handed to Pitt. The photos showed bow and portside views of the blue yacht moored at a dusty facility. Pitt didn't fail to notice that none of the photos showed the starboard flank, where he had rammed the yacht. The last photo showed a close-up of a Lebanese daily newspaper with the present date, the yacht appearing in the background. Gunn leaned over Pitt and studied the photos. "That sure looks like the same boat," he said reluctantly. He could only nod when Pitt showed him the photo of a life ring that clearly showed the yacht's name. Pitt simply nodded, finding no evidence that the photos had been doctored. "It doesn't belie the fact that one of our scientists was also kidnapped and taken to the yacht's facility up the coast," Pitt said.
"Yes, our department contacted the local police chief at Kirta, who sent a man to investigate the dock facility you described." He turned and nodded to his assistant, who retrieved a thick packet from his case and handed it to his supervisor. "You may have a copy of the report that was filed in Kirta. I've taken the liberty of having it translated into English for you," the officer said, handing it to Pitt while giving him an apologetic look. "The investigator reported that not only were the ships you described absent from the harbor, there were in fact no vessels at all at the facility."
"They certainly covered their tracks quickly," Gunn remarked.
"The facility records indicate a large freighter similar to the one you described was at the dock earlier in the day, taking on a shipment of textiles. However, the records indicate that the vessel left harbor at least 8 hours before your alleged arrival at the facility."
The officer looked at Pitt with a sympathetic gaze.
"I'm sorry there is little else we can do at the moment, pending additional evidence," he added.
"I realize this has turned into a rather confusing incident," Pitt said, suppressing his frustration. "I wonder, though, if you can tell me who owns the shipping facility near Kirta."
"It is a privately held company called Anatolia Exports. Their contact information is in the report."
He looked at Pitt with a pensive gaze.
"If there is any additional service I can provide, please let me know."
"Thank you for your assistance," Pitt replied tersely. As the police officers left the boat, Gunn shook his head.
"Unbelievable. 2 murders and a kidnapping, and nobody is at fault but us."
"It's a raw deal, all right," Captain Kenfield said. "Only because we're playing against a stacked deck," Pitt said.
"Anatolia Exports apparently bought off the Kirta police. I think our resident constable recognized that."
"I suppose the whole situation was a bit embarrassing for them, so perhaps they're just trying to save face," Kenfield said.
"They should be more concerned with doing their job," Gunn swore.
"I would have thought they'd be jumping through hoops after you told them that you spotted the woman from the Topkapi theft," Kenfield said to Pitt.
Pitt shook his head.
"I didn't tell them anything about her."
"Why not?" Gunn asked incredulously.
"I didn't want to endanger the ship anymore while we're in Turkish waters. We've seen firsthand what they're capable of doing, whoever they are. Plus, I had a sneaking suspicion it would go nowhere with the local police."
"You're probably right about that," Kenfield said.
"But we just can't let them walk away," Gunn protested.
No, Pitt agreed with a determined shake of the head. And we won't.
The lines had been cast, and the Aegean Explorer was inching away from the dock when a dilapidated yellow taxi came roaring into view. The rusty vehicle skidded to a stop at the water's edge. The rear door flew open, and a tall, slender woman jumped out. Pitt was standing on the bridge when he spotted his daughter running along the dock.
"It's summer," he shouted to the captain. "Hold the boat!"
Pitt ran down to the main deck, ducking when a large duffel bag came flying through the air and landed at his feet. A second later, a thin pair of hands appeared on the side rail, followed by a bushel of red hair. Summer then swung her body over the side, landing on her feet on the forward deck. Pitt approached, holding her bag, and gave her a clenching hug.
"You know we were coming back to get you," he said with a laugh.
Realizing that the ship had reversed power and was returning to the dock, Summer gave her father a sheepish look.
"Sorry," she said, still catching her breath. "When I phoned the ship from London, Rudy told me you'd probably be here for another day or two. But when the taxi neared the dock, I saw you pulling away and panicked. I really didn't want to miss the boat."
Pitt turned and waved up to the bridge, indicating it was safe to depart. Then he casually escorted Summer to her cabin.
"I wasn't expecting to see you for another few days," he said.
"I took an earlier flight from London and figured it would be easier to catch you here in Çanakkale coming from Istanbul."
Her face turned somber as she said,
"I heard about your shipwreck
and what happened to Tang and Iverson."
"We've had our share of trouble and excitement," he replied as they entered her cabin and he placed her bag on the bunk.
"Why don't we go grab a coffee in the wardroom and I'll tell you all about it."
"I'd like that, Dad. Then I can tell you all about what I've been up to in England."
"Don't tell me you've got a mystery of your own," he asked, smiling.
Summer gave her father an earnest gaze, then replied, "One bigger than you could ever imagine."